Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Kia ora koutou, New Zealand. This is Caucus. Thursday morning, 9:40, just gone. So by the time you might be listening to this, things might have changed because we're on the campaign trail, 37 days out from Election Day 2020. I'm Tim Watkin.
I'm Guy Espiner.
I'm Lisa Owen.
And I'm Scott Campbell.
And we're all here together. And Scotty was just joking. We were talking about rearranging his financial affairs, really.
Just been to the accountant, so I'm good now.
That's one of the things we're going to talk about today. In fact, let's kick off with that, because tax has been the discussion point for the past day or so, since Labor finally got some policy rolling out, which is nice to see. It's a lot of policies this week we're going to be talking about. So let's start with what Grant Robertson said Wednesday morning when he announced Labor's revenue policy.
So today I am announcing that the next Labor government will introduce a new top tax rate of 39% for the 2% of people who earn more than $180,000. The new rate will only have to be paid on any income earned more than $180,000, so this will only affect the top 2% of earners. For 98% of people, there won't be any change. The new rate kicks in at the same income as Australia's top tax threshold of Australian $180,000, but Australians earning over this threshold pay a much higher rate, 47%, including their 2% Medicare levy. This policy is about everyone pitching in to do their bit to help our country rebuild, to protect the vital public services we all need, and to keep our debt under control as we continue our fight against this virus and drive our recovery.
So what do you make of that, guys? 2% only. Did you get that? Did you hear that? 98% of you will not be affected.
You started by saying tax. I think you mean
just a T policy rather than a full tax policy?
Well, if tax is love, this is a peck on the cheek from your grandma.
It's an elbow bump.
I mean, it's an elbow bump in social in social distancing terms. I mean, look, I mean, Don Brash had a harsher tax policy than this in 2005. What, $500 million a year you're going to get from it? Okay, it's not nothing, but it's very, very small. And really, it just... It ensures that Labor has signed up to the neoliberal consensus, basically. They've put the capital gains tax on the never. They're going to gain very small amounts of revenue from this, and it's really just around the margins, isn't it?
To frame it as anything to do with the virus or a COVID response is nonsense, isn't it? $500 million a year out of this new tax take is 1 week's worth of wage subsidy. 1 week worth of wage subsidy.
And that's assuming that they're actually going to get the $500 million,
and
to say that everybody has to pitch in, but we're only targeting the top 2% of earners. And generally what happens at that sort of level, obviously if you're in an employee role, you're going to be taxed, but a lot of the people who are in that level of revenue and income will just go and restructure their affairs so that they all of a sudden are now earning less than $180,000. But it is window dressing though, right? It's hardly transformational. And I think interestingly enough, I heard the minister during the press conference talk about the fact that it's the right policy for this time. And I guess what that tells you is that we're surviving the next 3 years and look out for 2023-24 and that sort of election term and the next term of the next government. But it's window dressing. Hmm.
It's arguably spin. It goes further than that because let us count the ways. In terms of his cents in the dollar, he says it's a reasonable amount. As Scotty's point out, it's only 2% of the population. The problem we have here, and we know that the wealthiest people in the country are wealthy because of assets,
yes,
right? Not because of the wage check they get every week. So that those assets are going unchecked. He talks about COVID, as you pointed out, Tim, but what COVID, it's not related to COVID specifically. only in so much that COVID gives them the social licence to slide it past the goalie, in the sense these are unprecedented times, one in 100 year shock. We need to circle the wagons. Let's go with something that is reasonable. It's going to give us $550 million a year. It's going towards COVID debt. He specifically stated that in his press material. But relative to the size of that debt, it's nothing, and he accepts that. And I spoke to him last night, and he was talking about the fact that he kept emphasising it's right for right now, it's right for right now. So I said to him, what would you have done if it wasn't for this? And he...
It's a hypothetical, Lisa.
Exactly. And when I asked him if his policy would have been vastly different, he said, not particularly.
Yeah, and I don't... I was trying to think my way through this. The right for this time argument, what does it actually mean? For me, I don't buy that, because we know that from Labor Party tradition, from the tradition of Grant Robertson and Jacinda Ardern, these are people who want capital gains tax, that they believe in it. They have fought for it for years until they couldn't get it through politically, and so they've given up on it. They want... they say openly that one of their main policy goals is income inequality generally. And as you say, a lot of that's around wealth and assets these days. So they want to do something more than this. I cannot believe they don't.
They want to win.
So yes, I think you're right, is that people are scared right now. Right. Well, and so people are nervous and people are anxious because of COVID, and they think that maybe if they go too far in tax, that general feeling of fear could turn on them. I think
it's right for now that we're in an election campaign, and that anything more than this would have been political suicide. And I think people are scared and anxious. And all of a sudden, if we're in this position where I'm losing my job and now all of a sudden I might have the potential of another tax, be it a small one, I think anyone would have got scared by that. The other side of the equation, the Nats are saying, well, we won't do this and we won't do that. So all of a sudden they would have come back into the game. I just think it's political, it's smart, because anything more I think would have hurt them. I think this gives them a little bit of that, well, we're having a crack at the people who earn the most money. It's not quite the Greens' envy tax, but it's still a tax. I think it is right for the right time, but I don't think it's what they wanted to do from a transformational point of view.
I totally agree with that. It also allows them to draw a line under exactly what they will do. Where they were punished last election, if you remember, going right back to 2017, was they had all these maybes and there were all these potentials, and it allowed their enemies to come and say, oh, well, they might tax land and wealth and inheritance and all sorts of things. Now they're saying, a la the pledge card under Helen Clark, this is what we'd do and no more. And so it allows less room for their opponents to dream up all sorts of
stuff. But it is very different from what, I mean, you go back to 2014, Cunliffe was talking about a 36% tax rate on an income over $150,000, and putting up the trust. If you go back to Gough, he was talking about that tax-free zone, remember, under $5,000, and the big tax switch, a much more radical approach. Clark was 39%. Clark and Cullen was 39% at 60 grand.
Yeah, well,
this is way different.
That's what I want to raise. So if you were deeply concerned with the fairness argument, which we must assume that a Labor Party would be, then should you be tinkering with the top, or should you be moving the bottom of those income tax brackets? Because Grant Robertson can't stop saying the tax rate in Australia, which is, 45 cents?
47
in the top, right? He can't stop talking about that. But what he omits to mention is that you get $18,000 in Australia for nicks, for tax. So if it's about fairness, he has identified only 2% of the population are in that 180 plus.
Problem with those,
most are underneath.
Yes. Problem with those policies is so does the multimillionaire get the $18,000 tax free.
Yeah. And it's fair, it goes right through the system, doesn't it?
So you lose a lot of revenue for a limited gain on the bottom.
You do lose a lot of revenue, but what you're doing with that top tax rate is you're pinging 2% of the population, very small. You're not giving your core base anymore. At the very least, you wonder, and this has been a subject of discussion for the National Party, when you look at the median wage or average wage, there are people who are knocking those higher tax levels when their wages are not that high
in terms
of the cost
of
living. But it's a question of, if you're going to do that and raise the top tax bracket, there's some consideration that needs to be done, given to that the core and even the lower levels of income and the amount of tax that they are contributing relative to their income. And I realise there is a cost to that, in that you lose some cream from the wealthy people who also pay that. So why not give a break at the bottom and fire up higher at the top, if that is what your party is about, fairness and redistribution?
Well, it's interesting. Fun OECD facts. I've got a couple of fun OECD facts today. New Zealand is currently eighth lowest in the OECD out of 36 countries, with its top tax rate at 33%. If we move to 39, we'll be 12th lowest still. So we're still in the bottom third, even with the increase. So we, you know, internationally, Scotty, we're still quite low on the old top tax rate. But as Lisa says, we don't have some of these other outs.
Yeah, but I honestly just think that it's a tax policy without being a tax policy, right? It's something that they've had to do because we all expected them to have a tax policy during an election campaign. The reality is they're facing this global pandemic that still has uncertainty around it. I don't want to sound like I'm talking from their key messaging book, but I just think that it's taken some of the wind out of the sails from the National Party. It's allowed them to at least say that they've had a tax policy. It's given them, what, $2 billion over the next term to have some new money for spending. And it allows them to then go into the next part of the campaign and say, you've got clarity. Don't believe what Judith Collins is telling you. You've got clarity. We're not going to do it. We'll wait for 3 years while money is still cheap, and we'll go and try and survive the next 3 years, and we'll worry about it in the next term.
So bottom line, it is politics disguised as policy.
And bottom line, National has won the tax argument in New Zealand for this decade, basically, haven't they? Is that fair to say that Labor's basically opted out of the tax fight now?
Yeah, and you're not going to see a capital gains tax for, what, at least a decade, if not more. Yeah. I mean, National wouldn't do it if they got back in, and Jacinda Ardern, who's looking pretty good to lead a government for another term at least, has said that not in her political career.
Life. Yeah.
And just picking up on your words, leading a government, so that's the other big question. If Labor is presented with a scenario where it is in with the Greens that have a much tougher tax policy, who's going to give here?
And so this is what I'm really fascinated in, and you got into this with Grant Robertson last night on Checkpoint. So Jeremy, let's have a listen to that.
Are you saying this is absolutely a bottom line for tax? Or if, for example, you go in with the Greens and they want more and they dig their toes in, is this negotiable?
This is the tax policy that we will be implementing as a Labor government,
whether you're in coalition or not.
As I say, we're campaigning for ourselves. This is what an election is about. Other parties are fully entitled to campaign for
I understand that. I really do understand that. But what I'm saying is it's one thing to promise people that this is Labor's policy, and it's another to say that regardless of what any partners in government want, you are going to stick with this. So I'll just ask it again to be absolutely sure. Is this your bottom line in terms of income tax policy if you need to form a coalition or a confidence and supply agreement?
A Labor government will be implementing the policy that we announced today, Lisa. It's not a matter of bottom lines when for us from this perspective. And I haven't actually heard the Green Party use that phrasing either. From our perspective, this is what we will implement, just what we announced today.
Vital words, Labor government, and I see you with your uncommitted pencil there writing them down, Tim. Explain.
Well, is he just said a Labor government would do that, but would a Labor-led government not change its tax policy? Is a Labor government, if he gets 47, 48, 50% and cannot govern alone, he's put a line in the sand. But if it's a Labor-led government, has he kept that door open, or has he not?
I think it's an interesting argument. It was a great interview, and he didn't like having to be pinned down like that. But I don't personally think there's much realistic chance that they would deviate from it. The Greens have been very poor at negotiating big policy wins, and I can't see the Greens sort of throwing their toys and not signing up to that. My own view is if Labor leads the government, that will be the tax policy. The Greens will get some add-ons around the margins, and the Greens will probably take what they can get because they're not going to be in a terribly strong position.
I would bet all of my taxable salary and the tax I pay in my house and anything else on the fact that the Greens will not take this as the final word. The Greens will go to the table.
Are we the beneficiaries of that?
You better ring Scotty's accountant.
I reckon that the Greens aren't just going to back away from this fight and say, oh, okay, Grant, if you say taxes off the table, taxes off the table. If they get their 6 or 7 or 8% at the election, they will go to that negotiating table and say, excuse me, Grant, we're talking tax today.
Sure they will. Yeah. I'm sure they will. And they'll go hard at that table. And depending on who else potentially is at that table will decide whether or not they have an impact. I think that they'll ride out the next 3 years. And if the Greens are still around, that they might get a crack at the next government, possibly, depending on where Labor finishes on election night. I can't see them really deviating from where they're at the moment. They know that they don't have a lot of room to move when it comes to spending. They won't want to cut services. They also know that the top end of town are going to be the ones that will bring the economy back when we do have a rebound at some point in time. Our essential workers and our people who are on the ground every day are doing a fantastic job, but we're going to need those businesses and those larger scale economies to actually get us back in the game. And in a couple of years' time, when we do see a rebound, Labor won't want to have isolated that part of town.
No, fair point.
What about ACT? Did you guys see ACT this week with their debt destroyer? And I found it, and maybe this got missed, but there was a line in David Seymour's press release which talks about borrowing now and forgetting tomorrow is fiscal child abuse. Fiscal, not physical.
Yeah.
But I thought that was just amazing.
Well, he's saying that the kids are going to be paying this off for their whole entire lifetimes.
Which they are. But just the terminology-wise, I thought that's not very kind of where we are at the moment.
I think Seymour's got some license to go down that way, doesn't he, for his voters?
Well, he called, he was throwing the fascist word around. He seemed to think that a public holiday, extra public holiday, was fascism, which I suppose he's trying to get noticed, and I suppose he has done.
Let's talk about extra public holidays, because that was another big policy this week. Labor say Matariki will be a national holiday, presumably sometime in late June or July, but date to be confirmed, depending on the seasons in the year. What do we reckon, guys? Is this written in the stars or is it...
Well, straight out of the gate, it was populist policy. And, I mean, you've got to give them some points for that when you're on the campaign trail. And it was the first day of the campaign, wasn't it, where she rolls out this prospect.
Can we just stop? I just love the fact that how things change. Because in 2020, describe... Matariki as a populist policy, making it a public holiday. Yeah, it's kind of cool. No, I just think it's interesting. I didn't want to interrupt, but I just thought just to press pause there. It's interesting, isn't it, that could be considered. And I don't disagree with you, but I just think it's worth reflecting very briefly.
It's not being played as a divisive or a cult, you know.
Just it just wouldn't have happened in the 2005 or 2008 election.
So race based holidays,
and it didn't. It didn't because it came up in 2009. Ahui Katinia, then as the Māori Party, one Māori Party MP, took this to Parliament and National rubbished it. Mm. National didn't even allow it to get to the first reading. It was put as a members' bill, and National didn't let it go through.
And it was laughed out of town and so-called mainstream thinking wouldn't even have known what it was. So we we've got a mile to go, but it is interesting that at least, you know, this is being greeted. And I agree with you. It's kind of like it's populist now, which is just worth reflecting on.
Absolutely. And it ticks boxes in terms of the unity message that Jacinda Ardern speaks to a lot of the time.
This is the treat at the end of the 5 million team, 5 million, having done its bit. Here's your reward for good behaviour.
That's how, I mean, politically, that's how we would frame it. And also, in my mind, is the Christchurch mosque attacks. This ticks this as proposed holiday ticks the unity box, the team box, and it also ticks the fatigue box, because we've talked about this before. Yes. You know, people are fatigued. 2020 has been a tough year for a lot of people.
In two more years, you'll get another holiday.
Yeah.
It's 2020. Yeah. No. Hang in there and then you can get a rest.
It's deferred, gratification.
It's a bit like the tax policy in that respect,
but,
isn't it?
But so I thought it was politically astute move. And where does that leave the others? You position yourself as the Grinch,
being
don't
Grinches,
you?
Yeah, I was going to say. Yeah.
And it does.
I think ironically, though, it's actually probably been more controversial in the Māori world as opposed to the mainstream world. I've seen a lot of discontent in the Māori world about this policy. And people, yes, I think supportive, absolutely, like Guyan has said about this being a mainstream policy now, and like Lisa was just touching on. But in the Māori world, there actually has been a lot of people who have been knocking it and saying, well, actually, it's fantastic to finally recognise it. Thank you very much. But what about all of the other problems we have? And is this now our big policy for Māori? Are you going to give us an extra day off?
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Yeah. I mean, what have the Labour Māori caucus got to offer up? I mean, what have they done? I mean, is this it? And it is interesting, isn't it, to put it alongside some of the other things. I mean, if you go back to Helen Clark and that Labour-led government, I mean, they piled hundreds of millions into closing the gaps. Yeah, they got a lot of flack for it, but there was some real putia put up there. And what have we got here? We've got I'm not knocking Matariki as a holiday and acknowledging that and the Māori New Year. Great. But I
talked to Scott about this yesterday, and we were making the same point. There is an element where this feels a little bit beads and blankets, doesn't it? Is you give people something shiny and nice like a holiday, whereas what Māori policy surely needs to be focused on is inequality stats. Material hardship hasn't changed in the past 3 years. And our Prime Minister is the Minister of Child Poverty Reduction, has made very little progress.
Very little progress. I went out
and
to Auckland,
surely the Māori
Auckland
policy that matters, isn't
in
it?
South Auckland this week for a story, and was told that 67% of their inmates are Māori at that prison.
Yeah.
67.
And this takes time, right? I get that 3 years is a tough measure to change generational stuff.
I'm not expecting them to turn all that around, but you know, I mean, they haven't made a lot of progress.
They haven't.
Have they? Or have they, Scott?
I think a lot of the Labour caucus, and particularly a couple of the ministers, will fire back and say, well, we got $1 billion in the last budget, which is targeted towards Māori. And yes, that might be true. There has been extra spend in whānau order and te māngai pāho and other areas. But I think it is, for me, they had the opportunity in May when this came up as the potential for a holiday, as an acknowledgement towards Matariki, but also the opportunity to give us that feel-good factor out the back of lockdown. And they didn't jump on it there. And so I just think, obviously, it's politics. It's good politics. It is something that's been latched on by a lot of people. But I do think it'll be interesting under the next term how much input that Māori caucus actually has at the cabinet table. Mm-hmm. Where's Pini Hinari?
Let's put it out there. Is he going to be the health minister after the next election if they're in government? He's expressed an interest in it. And they're on the verge of, the Heather Simpson report, the biggest health report in two decades, the supposed blueprint of which the government has not given us a clear commitment to which elements it's going to introduce, including a Māori health authority that the majority of those people on the panel felt was toothless and didn't go far enough. Potentially you address that issue by a changing of the guard. Chris Hipkins takes it through to the election.
Yeah.
And then if you're in there, you send a strong signal by putting someone in there who is a Māori cabinet minister for a portfolio that could have significant impact on Māori given their poor health statistics, and that being the...
possibly the key...
The capital of your people.
And a lot of it will depend too, won't it, on whether Winston Peters and New Zealand First are there, because they have always pushed back on those so-called race-based policies, right? And you'll run up against that because there's a real different...
So if you saw a Labour
Green government, if they were, let's say, able to govern, then you might see some freeing up of that kind of policy direction, because you get get a lot of pushback from New Zealand First on those kinds of policies, usually, don't you?
Yeah, because what we're talking about, and this segues into the National Party, what we're talking about is targeting, right? Targeting of funds and resources. Mm. And interestingly, Judith Collins has resurrected the concept of social investment, which was a massive policy under Bill English, and I find it actually quite fascinating. But so that is, well, that's extreme. That's targeting in the extreme. So you look at the people who are most poorly represented in various elements, and you target your policies and your money towards that. And
are we talking about their drug policy specifically this
week? Well, so this week, well, there's been a couple of policies. Yep. There has been the methamphetamine program, which is, in essence, if we look at it in broad brushstrokes, is viewing that level of drug consumption as a health problem, you know, rather than chuck them in jail and lock them up kind of scenario. Or they still want to do that with the dealers, but they're talking about users who are not selling. And then also their policy for parents, where they're going to give you a chunk of money, basically, that you can spend. It's almost like a voucher system, isn't it?
Well, I was going to say, it's not a chunk of money, it's a chunk of vouchers.
Yeah, it's a chunk of vouchers with top-end $6,000. If you are identified as being a high risk, you get more money, you get a navigator sat on your shoulder who will help you as a parent choose services, which may be parenting courses, you know, all sorts of assistance, social assistance programs, up to the value of $6,000 if you're considered high risk, $3,000 if you're not. Those are interesting policies from a National Party and are under that umbrella of social investment, which Bill English, well, he championed. He was the father of that, wasn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. What do you make of those policies this week? We've seen, the meth guy and the baby bonus being talked about. What are you seeing in that?
Yeah, it's interesting. It's a softening of the Crusher Collins image, I guess, and you know, some carrot and stick there, as Lisa says, on the meth policy, and the baby bonus thing. I think it's good that National's taking its policy development quite seriously. They seem to have put quite a lot of thought into that and to this National Infrastructure Bank. So they're not just going, well, we're the underdogs, we're just going to fling crazy policy around and whipping up sort of populist hysteria and going at the fringes, are they?
No.
It's quite a moderate approach, really, I think, from Judith Collins.
Yeah, some of those policies actually are fairly reminiscent of whānau ora. Like the voucher system and the navigator on your shoulder actually sounds like whānau ora.
Even the terminology, Scotty?
Absolutely. And so take a look at how softening they are becoming. I think what it does show, and I think what, and Shane Retty actually showed this in Gone, I know you were a fan of him a couple of weeks back, and he's come to the fore with this health approach as well too, on the 5 points that the government should be picking up. I think the difference at the moment, what we're seeing, is that National are going to focus on delivery. And I don't know if you've seen the new National Party ads that have just come out recently, but they have delivery in almost every second word. It's about delivery and confidence. And I think where they're going to try and put themselves is, we have done the thinking. We have come up with some policy ideas. We won't scare you going into the next campaign, but we also know that it's going to be tough and going into the next term. And I think that's the difference between the two.
Well, the not scaring is interesting, because this is what Judith Collins said on Morning Report a couple of days ago.
If houses are being used for dealing meth, absolutely. In fact, if they're being used for dealing meth, that is a total breaking of the social contract than what people would expect. But if we're dealing with people who have an addiction and they are trying to deal with that addiction and they want to get help, I think we've got to be much kinder about that and understand that addictions are a very serious issue.
Kinder Collins, not Crusher Collins.
And you could hear it. Am I going to use this word?
We need to be a bit kinder.
Yeah. The context and there was the, obviously the old National Party policy around meth testing in state houses.
If there's 0.1 millionth of a gram sort of
on your
wafting
wallpaper
around in the ether somewhere, you were out of the state house. I mean, that was a debacle.
But she also said in that interview, we can't arrest a way out of it. Now, that's a fascinating line for a, you know, because National Party policy has been to arrest its way out of it.
It was interesting, I think it was you, Tim, said that it does show that National had won the economic argument over the last, and this shows that Labor Labor's probably won the social argument.
Yeah, I think that's a fair point. Because the baby bonus is interesting, but it's certainly heavy state intervention. It does. I think there's some risk in that. I was looking at it last night, and they're taking the universal element off the $60 a week that everybody gets in cash and replacing with vouchers.
If I'd asked you 10 years ago, like, whose policies are these? I'm going to set up a new bank.
Exactly.
I'm going to give a baby bonus, and I'm going to introduce more rehabilitation programs for meth addicts. Exactly. You probably would have guessed Labor. So it's quite interesting. It is.
Not a new Thatcher. This is not the party of Brash or Richardson, is it? This is a very different...
No, and we're in the middle of a deadly global pandemic, and so the times are different. So they are being quite imaginative, I think, in setting their sort of policy compass.
They're pinching ideas from the other team and expanding on them.
So that's what you do to win the centre.
Yeah, the baby bonus was already in existence, obviously, from Labor. This is sort of an extension and, as Scotty says, borrowed stuff, like it appears to be from Whānau Ora. On the meth program, I would point out this idea that if you're just a user, you get diversion to a treatment program. Under Labor, there's already Te Ara Oranga, which does the same. The path to wellbeing. Police have the opportunity to exercise discretion. If they pick you up in a bust and you're not a dealer, you can go to a treatment program and have intervention. So it already exists. And in their meth policy announcement, they also said they were going to set up a fund, right? Yep. So the proceeds of crime, and it would be targeted towards meth and drug rehabilitation. And there'd be a clear criteria for that. Well, we already have the Proceeds of Crime Fund, which is a contestable fund, and with a set criteria about what projects can get funding from that, and one of them is meth programs.
Or we could use the $1 billion from the cannabis tax and put it to meth. So we could legalise one drug to fund the health of another.
Well, it's interesting that you raise that, because on the one side, here they are announcing their meth policy. And then on the other side, Judith Collins has already come out in a rather brash way and said, none of my MPs are going to be voting to legalise cannabis. We've agreed as a collective, we ain't doing it.
But it's still, I think you're right, G, that it feels like, Labor's kind of won the wellbeing argument and National's won the tax argument. But
although I did find interesting, though, this week, those numbers that were trying to be withheld, well, maybe withheld is maybe too strong a word, but the government weren't that forthcoming with the Ministry of Justice figures around how many shops would be established and, you know, selling cannabis, and how many extra users and this supposed $1 billion that they might get through it, which I found quite interesting this week from government. What I do see is a National Party that has the luxury of not being the government currently, so it has time to develop policy. Some of these are good. The great thing, I reckon, is we've got a contest of ideas at the moment, and whether or not we hear all of them from every party coming up soon, I think the good thing is that National is actually being able to show some policy.
Yeah, and one of them we've mentioned briefly, because we'll just have to touch on this very briefly, guys, is the Infrastructure Bank, which Judith Collins mentioned this week, which she announced this way.
I believe as we head into the biggest infrastructure spend our country has ever seen, that we need a long-term disciplined plan for financing and managing infrastructure. Today I'm announcing National's plan for a single national infrastructure bank. The National Infrastructure Bank would provide additional finance needed to fund our infrastructure rebuild. Local council and Crown entity borrowing is often small in scale compared to other global products. The National Infrastructure Bank would package together loans from Crown agencies and local government to provide a product more appealing to large-scale investors.
Guy, you were really interested in this,
weren't
you?
Well, yeah, I like myself a good infrastructure bank or a sovereign wealth fund or something. It's a fairly sober sort of announcement, isn't it? I don't think you're going to be sort of marching in the streets over it. And I do wonder whether they are using this to sort of take the debt off the government accounts and so that it doesn't look quite as bad for them.
To be fair, Labor's been doing with Housing New Zealand and Crown Infrastructure Partners
and
so forth.
But I do like the idea of a more independent Crown financial institution. I think we've had problems, we've talked about them before on this podcast, with the Provincial Growth Fund or the Green Investment School, some of those debacles you get. Look, no matter what your political stripes are, politicians like to get their mitts on programs that are going to benefit their constituents.
Yep, back into their communities.
Yeah, and so I like the idea of something a bit more independent that can actually lend some expertise to this without sort of having the politicians as involved.
And Scott, as our provincial member here, you know, local councils are in all kinds of dire straits, aren't they, in terms of ageing populations and lowering revenue streams and so forth. They're going to need to figure out ways to borrow to just to keep the water flowing and the roads going, right?
Yeah, especially ours. Tauranga City Council is in all sorts of trouble. And that,
but it's all over the country, man.
It's all over the country, but a lot of them are behind in their infrastructure spend. And when we've got growth into the regions and we're pushing people out into the regions, they just can't keep up. So, yeah, I'm a fan of it. I quite like the idea. I know that a lot of iwi have always wanted to try and get closer to the likes of the Super Fund and to ACC and those ones. And some of them are already doing that, your big ones, your Tainui, your Ngaitahu. So I think it's a great idea.
Let's, before we finish, talk about TV debates, because this is always fascinating. And we've had a... Well, TVNZ's changed their mind. It was going to be multi-party debate. We're not allowed to call the minor parties anymore. The multi-party debate was going to be New Zealand First, the Greens, and who am I missing?
ACT.
And now, all of a sudden the Māori Party and Advanced New Zealand are in the mix as well.
Well, I think, first off, we need to consider their criteria, right?
Yes.
So it was, originally, was it not, you had to rate 3% in a poll? Or you had to have a sitting member in Parliament.
And this is where we can say...
Well, I invented this.
I was going to say, Guyan and I were in this meeting...
about 10 years
ago.
So
you're to blame.
Yeah, well, no, this was. I remember it well, 2011.
Back at TVNZ, we were like, yes, OK, how are we going to do this? I was political editor at the time. I thought, well, OK, we're going to have a criteria. It was 3%. You had to hit 3% in one of two Colmar Brunton polls leading up to the election.
Exactly.
First one comes back and New Zealand First doesn't make it anything close. The second one comes back and it's at 2.9. Of course.
I tell you, that day in the newsroom, the arguments that were going around, do we include New Zealand First?
Technically, Peters was
Swedish
out.
Swedish rounding.
We thought, look, we give the guy a shot and put him in the debate. He
well,
goes
it was,
into the
it was
debate,
inside,
he
it was,
cleans
it was
up
the
on
rounding.
The night completely, gets back into Parliament, and he's never thanked me. I'm still waiting for the phone call.
He was 2.9 in the headline rate, but inside in the polling, it was rounded to 3, and so he had earned his way in,
right,
about 3%.
Yeah.
The point is that it's not 2011 anymore.
No.
And we don't have those parties sitting around the 3% margins. The smaller parties are much smaller, and for some reason, TVNZ did not review its criteria and has now got stuck.
Well, there's a couple of things there, interesting and inconsistencies. So the Māori Party, by that criteria, the 3% and a sitting member, they don't meet
nowhere
that,
near,
right? Whereas Jamie Lee Ross does meet one. He is a current Member of Parliament, yet
yep,
seemingly... He
wasn't in the first list.
But was voted in as a National Party.
Correct.
MP,
yes.
Right?
Yes.
Correct. But as the rules stand, he has the right to break away and become an independent as an electorate MP.
Yeah. I guess the Māori Party's argument, and you've got other, you've got treaty principles possibly and other constitutional things at play there, obviously, too. But, I mean, they could make a similar argument to David Seymour. David Seymour's ACT Party wouldn't be anywhere near Parliament if it wasn't for the fact that he is gifted a seat by the National Party. It may be different this time and he may win 3, 4, 5, 6%, who knows. But the Māori Party essentially saying, look, you don't poll the Māori seats, that's how we're looking to get in.
That's right. We've got a decent shot of being in Parliament.
And actually, that's how David Seymour's in there. Because
let's have a look to what John Tamahiri said was their main argument.
They were wrong because this country was settled by consent, not by conquest. And we have a constitutional right as Māori people to represent our interests under a Māori flag and a Māori banner. We couldn't be penalised in 2020 New Zealand for that. So they were wrong constitutionally. They were wrong because we've had separate Māori representation in the Parliament, even though it arrived late, since 1867. 150 years it's taken, and in 2020 New Zealand, we still get denied access to a basic right of freedom of speech and to have that speech broadcast on platforms. So they were wrong.
Scott?
I think policy on the hoof a little bit to let it come back. I do think I agree with him in the sense that the Māori Party and the Māori seats, sorry, let me say the Māori seats have an impact on the makeup of Parliament, or they have done before. And so I think that given that there is there should be an expectation that the Māori Party or a Māori voice is a part of the debate. I accept that. What I don't like is this, we were banned and we were kept out, and that's just appealing to this audience that John Tamahere and the Māori Party are trying to get to at the moment, which is the activist sort of voice. I think that they should be there. I feel sorry for the guys at top, to be honest, and it's probably the first and last time that you ever hear me say it, but they are actually, I believe, they're actually contributing to the debate in the community, and I think if anybody deserves to be there, it's probably them.
Yeah, I'd agree with that, and I think the solution now is you have a multi-party debate where you have the leaders of the parties who are in Parliament, and National and Labour usually don't want to be in that, so that's fine. And then you have a contenders debate, which are the people outside Parliament who are trying to get in. And maybe you set a criteria there and say the top five polling ones or whatever the criteria you make. But, broadcasters have to get this stuff right.
The criteria has to be consistent.
How many times has this happened? We've had court cases. We've had all sorts. I do think that TVNZ hasn't...
Colin Craig shoehorning himself into...
I remember that Friday afternoon in court, Lisa.
But Greens and New Zealand First will be the losers out of this because it's less airtime for them. I mean, they were looking at ACT, New Zealand First and Greens, and now they have to contend with Jamie Lee Ross, John Tamahere, who are both, no matter what you think of those two, they're both pretty good debaters. They will suck up some airtime there, and I think that'd be quite an interesting debate.
Look, with respect to our friends at TVNZ, I think you're right. They've stuffed this up royally. The other point is that meeting that where we talked about in 2011 and set these criteria, I remember that being in March. And then we stuck to it, right? You cannot change your mind 5 weeks out from an election. I just think that's a really bad look. You have to have it. It would be a surprise to no one that the Māori Party were going to kick up stink being left out and make the very arguments they are. We're in a Black Lives Matter zeitgeist year. Of course there's going to be debate around this, and of course they should be in the TV debates. I think the constitutional arguments are a slightly ropey one. They're not being denied free speech. They have there will be plenty of news coverage around the Māori Party, and we're talking about them now. So they're not being denied. They don't have a right to be on a particular debate, but they should be there.
It is a fair argument to make that if you are setting a poll criteria, yet you fail to poll Māori electorate seats. Yes.
You only get what you measure, right? Yes, if you're not measuring that.
But that is a fair argument.
To play devil's advocate to the argument around top and the others, and look, the new Conservatives are polling better than any of these other guys at the moment, so arguably they should be there before anybody. But there is a part of the argument is you've got to earn it, don't you? You actually have to earn a place on these debates.
But the other thing
is we're not getting more than a percent or two.
We're not polling properly either. I mean, this is the thing.
It also shows that
our traditional broadcasters aren't probably thinking a little bit wide enough, and maybe 2020 we've missed the boat a little bit. Numbers show now that more people go to YouTube for their news and for their broadcasts, obviously, and when the caucus gets there, they'll come and watch us as well. But they should be having the contender debate on YouTube or something.
Well, they can stream simultaneously. Exactly. But I do accept there are some issues just in terms of logistics. When you work in TV, and all of us have, you understand that if you corral all of these people into a space, you've got an hour, a commercial in an hour. So what are you getting, like 45 minutes on the hoof?
Yep.
I mean, you, depending on the numbers you've got there, you're talking three questions.
That's why I'm saying separated out. Have the minor party leaders in Parliament and then have a contender.
It's a good point. This is about the people who complain about this stuff never actually realise that time is finite. But when you produce this stuff, they say, there just needs to be more people in there. And you go, okay, so that means your 5.5 minutes that every contender gets is only four minutes.
That's what Scotty's saying too. Like, it doesn't have to be only a commercial hour. You can put it on YouTube, you can put it on demand, you can do whatever with it. I don't think they are being creative enough about it.
Maybe our caucus can make up the next contended debate.
Yeah, well, this is basically a New Zealand On Air funding application. Isn't it?
Bring it on. All right, that's us for this week. I think we need to wrap it up. Thank you, guys. Scotty, good on you, mate.
Got it. Thanks for having me.
Guy and Lisa, thank you.
Thank you, Tim. We can't wait to get your house when you lose that bet.
Yeah. Hey, Scotty, can you give me your name for your accountant, mate? I just need to...
I'll slip you a brown paper bag.
Okay. Again.
Next Thursday, we'll be back with another round of caucus. And you can listen, obviously, to any of the series on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. Have a great week, everyone.